Hello and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg. And today is the first time we have the pleasure to present to you SciLax Original, and our guest is Valérie Ries, who is forensic scientist at Police Grand Ducale Luxembourg, responsible for identifying and analyzing physical evidence related to fingerprint identification. Valérie, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited about it because, you know, I'm not doing a true crime podcast, but this is as far as I can get, obviously, so maybe expanding the listenership, I hope, or whatever. And yes, I have so many questions, but of course, as usual, we are setting the scene. So my first question to you is, what is forensic science?
So forensic science is quite a broad term in science in general. So what we actually mean by that term is we use different sciences in the name of justice. So this can be in biology, in chemistry, or even physics. You are not really just working within one field, which is actually a really, really nice thing. And that is something I was always very fascinated about. Forensic science, you can look at fingerprints, or you can look at substances of abuse. You could have archaeology, for example, where you look at the bones of the deceased to figure out how they died. You could look at car accidents, collision analysis. You could look at blood spatter. So it's a very broad term of different sciences, in fact, but they're all applied in the name of justice. So actually to find out what happened in the case of a criminal investigation.
And there is an elephant in the room, so I have to mention it already. Maybe not an elephant, I should be using some other comparison. But anyway, there is a problem with this science in forensic science, because unfortunately it's so present in our popular beliefs that people treat something as scientific when it's not, because of all the series, right? So very often what we see, we have to say it in the very beginning, what we see in the screen is totally not forensic science, is it?
So exactly, that's what we actually call the CSI effect. About 15 years ago or a bit more longer, when CSI, when all these shows came out, people were fascinated by it and they really believed that that is how the forensic scientists are working. Unfortunately, it's not like that. So we are not magicians. We do not have results within 10 minutes. But on the other hand, I must say, I think they do the shows quite well. And we should never forget that it is a TV show. I watched CSI as well from the beginning on. But for me, it was quite clear that that is not reality. It's the same in hospitals. If you watch Dr. House and you think that's the way that the doctor works, I mean, the problem is not with the TV shows. But it gave the people a bit of a false sense that forensic scientists can do anything and they know everything. And that is a bit of a problem. I mean, things take quite a long time. Sometimes analysis, especially with DNA and archaeology as well, these analyses can take quite a long time. If you're a fiber expert, for example, and you have to analyze, let's say, a rape, it takes quite a long time to look at all the fibers, the transfers. That can take a few months to just work on one case. And that is something I think that people have a bit of a false impression about because they were watching these TV shows.
Yeah, the impression is you press one button and exactly you get the result.
And I think it's the same in all the sciences. We do not have the best equipment all the time, the newest technology. So we need to work with the technology that is available. I mean, there are a lot of changes. There are a lot of new technologies coming out, but still we do not have touch screens and talk to each other always via video conference. I mean, these are things that people quite often forget because these shows do have quite big budgets, but that's unfortunately like in most science. Not the case.
Maybe even bigger than some of the police departments, I guess.
Definitely. That is anyway a very big issue in police in general, not just here, but in all the countries. I mean, we could see it over the last couple of years that we do not have that many people and we need to be very resourceful with the people that we have. There is a lot of work out there and there is an increase in the work that we are doing. But we also need the resources for that, not just the money, but also the people.
As you mentioned the increase, I think this is the right moment to ask you to ask the pop quiz question that we always have in our show. So as usual, listeners, remember, the question is now, but the answer only at the end of the podcast.
Luxembourg is quite a small country. And the question that I often get is, Luxembourg is so tiny, so we do not have that much crime. And do you ever get any like major cases here? So the question that I am going to ask is, Can you guess how many analyses we did in 2019 in the laboratory only for fingerprints, and then in 2022 as well? And do you think that there was an increase or a decrease from 2019 to 2022?
Okay, so remember, answer only at the end of the podcast. And I guess this is one of these things that you can't easily Google. So, you know, because I'm always afraid that when we ask a question, I say like, listen until the end, people will just find the answer and stop listening. But here, I think we're going to talk about something that most of our listeners will not know about. So it's very good that you ask that question. Coming back to your work, you said you're a fingerprint expert. And what does that really mean? I know that there are different steps. I know you have to have validation. There is the risk of bias. There is the risk of contamination of data, loads of different things, loads of risk and loads of problems. But let's start with just step by step. Let's say you wake up in the morning very early, I already know, and then you go to the lab. Is
exactly.
That a good assumption?
Yes. We have quite a lot of cases that we are working on and even need to work simultaneously on a couple of cases. So we are a few people working in the lab together to reveal fingerprints on various objects. What we do is that we separate the work between the four people a little bit to distribute it. And a normal day, we then check on our online system what kind of cases are available. We assign the next case to us, and then we head off to the lab. And it depends on how big the case is, how many objects we need to analyze. And the thing is, every case is different. So it can be that we have just a few bottles from a break-in. It can be knives that we need to look at. It can be an entire door that we need to look at for fingerprints. So you never know what kind of objects you will get and how much work you will have. Normally, we spend quite a few portion of our time in the laboratory doing the different analysis. But because we are working with fingerprints, we spend also a very big portion of our time in the photo studio, because each of our fingerprints that we reveal, we need to photograph, and they need to be at a certain size so that for the next step is giving it to the next colleagues who are working in the AFIS, which is the automatic fingerprinting identification system. And that is where they do the actual comparison of the fingerprints with suspects or people in the database. And that takes quite a lot of time. So each of these fingerprints need to be photographed separately, and the whole process in Photoshop or whatever tool we have available takes quite a lot of time. And then, of course, we have to do all the proofreading and checking each other's work as well. We've just been through the accreditation, the ISO 17025, which all fingerprinting lab in Europe need to have. So we need to do constant controls of our methods. Are they still valid? Do they still work? The solutions that we prepared for our analysis. So that is also a very, very big part of our job. So we don't just do casework all the time, but we also need to stay up to date with our accreditation.
And it's very important that you mention it, because, of course, we all know about cases where the forensic expert was called in and said like, yes, this is definitely the culprit, and then it was not, right? I mean, there is a lot of problem of just human mistakes as well.
Exactly. And it used to be also here in Luxembourg that the same people who go to the crime scene, so the crime scene technicians, they would also do the analysis afterwards of the objects that they recovered in the lab and then do the analysis in the AFIS system. So you would have actually the same person working on the entire case, and actually to avoid a certain degree of bias or to have certain controls in between, this was separated. So we have a completely different team that goes to the crime scene and actually recovers all the evidence. And then our team in the laboratory, we very rarely go to the crime scene, only for certain special occasions. And even within our team, we have people who do fingerprints, but we also have people who do biological substances. So that could be anything from semen to saliva analysis or blood spatter. We have people who do shoe impressions. We have ballistics. So, and this is done all by different people just to assure that we do not get into trouble as some people have in the past. And I think that is an important part to make sure that the quality stands above everything.
How do the fingerprints get delivered to you? So what's the process like? How are they collected? Okay, because I kind of, you know, of course, have my ideas, but probably they're very much not close to reality. So I know that, of course, when we talk fingerprints, we have different types of fingerprints. These may be the ones that are visible or invisible or 3D. That I kind of get. But of course, the biggest problem is the ones that are latent, right? So the invisible ones. And then you have to apply something to get it. So what's the process? Walk me through that.
We get different objects into the laboratory and we are looking on those objects for fingerprints. So these, as you just mentioned correctly, latent fingerprints, to reveal them, to make them visible for our team afterwards to do the analysis in the APHIS program, we use different analysis. So that depends on what type of objects we're actually getting into the laboratory. We make a difference between porous and non-porous substrates. The main difference is actually that our fingerprints, we have different glands, like on the entire body, that secrete fat, amino acids, different fluids. And depending on what kind of substrate we have, different components of these glands will stay on the surface. Porous surfaces, of course, they absorb these secretions. And in this case, we rather talk about amino acids. So they will be incorporated into paper or cardboard, for example. Whereas on the other hand, we have non-porous substrates and they do not absorb anything. So they actually have rather fatty fingerprints on top, as you can sometimes see when you look at a window, for example, especially when the kids have touched everything, you can see the fingerprints very well. So we are talking rather about those kind of substances. And based on that, we actually then take a decision on what kind of analysis we will be making. So of course, we can't just apply anything that we want. These have been validated. We have done our accreditation. So we've been through the whole process of making sure that these methods also work and that the solutions that we've prepared, that everything is up to standard. And we need to make regular checks so that we will never have a case where we use an expired solution or things like that. So that is also a very, very important part. So it's not that the fingerprints weren't there, but maybe the solution is expired or our machine didn't work. So there are various different techniques. And that is also something that is very important to look at.
You actually don't get the fingerprints to photograph. You actually get the objects. So exactly. As you said, I already imagine people coming from the crime scene with a door.
Yes, exactly. That can be anything. You can have bottles. You can have people drinking out of a cup. Something you have to be very careful about is I am only looking for fingerprints at that point. But there are a lot of other things that will be done with that object as well afterwards. So what about DNA? For a bottle, for example, if you would drink from a bottle, it's maybe more important to collect the DNA swab at the top of the bottle and look for fingerprints on the rest so you do not harm another analysis afterwards. And that is also very important to talk to the other experts and to not just focus only on the work that you are doing. It sounds sometimes very simple that you just get an object, okay, you look at what kind of material is it made of, and then you choose your method. But in the end, you also have to be very careful with other analysis because you can't interfere with other people's work as well.
Okay, it's good. A team playing kind of approach, of course. And you never know, because if you don't find anything, then definitely another expert might be called in, right? I mean, there is a decision on, depending, as you said, on the material, what you could apply first. But yeah, there might be more steps.
And you never know what exactly happened on the crime scene. And that is also important to have that certain degree of bias. You have not been on the scene, so you don't exactly know what has happened. So it's for the person who is actually leading the whole investigation to call in all the different experts so they can then have a meeting and then decide on which objects, what is going to be done. And that is especially in major cases, if we're talking about murders, it is the way we actually do it.
We're coming back to the powders that you applied. As you said, you can't just randomly choose. Okay, they are accredited, they are working, but it's not one powder for all, right? Because you said there are different surfaces, so you have to apply different techniques. What I understood is that if it's, I guess, the door probably or glass, then it's going to be a substance that then you remove, right? And then you take a picture or not exactly.
So that depends. The crime scene technicians, they do use a lot of powder on the crime scenes themselves. So if they have, for example, fingerprints on a window, as you just mentioned, they can't always...
They will
always...
not remove the window, I hope.
Exactly. And people wouldn't be too happy about it if the investigation takes a bit longer and they don't have their window. Wouldn't be great. So they use a lot of powder on the crime scene because it's just a technique that you can use on the crime scene and it's quite effective as well. For us, we don't use powders that much in the laboratory because we have techniques that are more performant. For example, the cyanoacrylate fuming technique.
Super glue.
Super glue, yes. Exactly. And it's literally not more than that. It's just made out of cyanoacrylate, which is actually the component inside of it. And it's just getting heated. So we have actually fumes that evaporate. And due to the humidity in the chamber, they will react with the humidity in the fingerprints. And you will have a very nice polymerized white fingerprint on top of your surfaces.
So you heat it up and you have like a spray type of thing that you apply, or how do you apply the super glue? Because, you know, it's still super glue, right?
So we actually have an entire fuming chamber, and nowadays it is much more sophisticated. Back in the days, back when I was at university as well, we used a fish tank, and you just used a normal heater to heat it up. And you had to be very careful because the fumes are quite corrosive, so it's not very good to inhale them. So nowadays you have an entirely closed fuming chamber. You heat it up to 120 degrees. And from about 110, you have the cyanoacrylate that actually starts to evaporate. You also have water in the chamber to get a certain degree of humidity that you need for the analysis to work. And during the polymerization phase, you can actually watch and see how your object slowly starts to get white. And the polymerization only takes place on the fingerprints, but you also need to be a bit careful. As with all the methods, there are always things that can interfere with the analysis. So it's not just that it only reacts with the amino acids from the fingerprints.
But that's for the smooth surfaces, right?
Yes.
And what about the porous ones? Because porous is, for example, paper, right? If mm-hmm. I'm touching right now this piece of paper and you want to get my fingerprints, then it won't work like that. You will not put it in the chamber there with the substance.
Exactly. So there are different methods that you can actually apply. The main or the most popular at the moment is indandion. And that is actually a very useful technique because beforehand they had ninhydrin, which is a very similar component, which actually colors the fingerprints purple, and it's called Roumann's purple that actually has been formed. So you can see the fingerprint quite well, but the indandion also has some fluorescence dye in it, which is actually really great. So you can see the fingerprints already a bit more in a pinkish color. But if you use a crimescope, for example, you have different wavelengths that you can use. And you can actually reveal the fingerprints in a fluorescence, which is really nice because it takes the entire background away. So if you have a fingerprint on top of a text or, let's say, a colored picture on a paper, you actually do not see the picture in the background, but you only see the fluorescence of the fingerprint.
And once again, you take a picture of that and then you analyze it.
So we take a picture of the fingerprint after we've revealed it, of each single one, and then we will give it to the next colleagues to do the analysis or the comparison at that point.
And now when we move on to the comparison, I know that you're not the one doing the comparison, but you are checking the work. You have to know it too. You had to study it too, right? So for sure, you're an expert here too, definitely more than me. So what were we talking about is that when you have a fingerprint, right, you have those lines for the lay people, but these are ridges, right?
Exactly. And you call furrows the valleys in between. So we actually make the difference between three levels of the characterization of the fingerprint. Level one would be the general pattern, for example, just an arc or whorl. So if you look at your own fingers, you can already identify the general pattern of your finger. Then you have the level two, which are, if you look a bit more closely, you can see that some lines, they stop or they suddenly merge into two lines. And these are called minutiae. So these are small little details that vary from each finger, from each person to person. And then you have the level three details, and that are the pores. So there you have to look very, very closely, and you can't really see that with your eyes. But these are even the more details that on your fingers.
And we are sure that every single fingerprint is unique. So there are no two other people having the same.
Everyone has different fingerprints. So in DNA, that was a question that came up quite a lot as well, is that twins do have the same DNA, but they still have different fingerprints. So you will be able to differentiate between twins with the fingerprints, but not the DNA.
When you are comparing the fingerprints, you're not really looking at each and every ridge, are you? There are points that you kind of identify or not.
You are looking at every single point on the fingerprint, but we always need to remember here that you very rarely get a nice proper fingerprint where you have hundreds of details in the fingerprint pattern. So you often just get partial prints or smudged ones, but there are standards, a minimum of details that you need to have And the minimum is to have 12 details on the fingerprint in addition to the pattern. So it's not just a decision that the examinator can take himself. And there's also, of course, always the cross confirmation from a colleague.
What I understood is that there are two main challenges with all this, except for getting actually the fingerprints, so that there are those 12 points. One challenge is that you can never know when it was left. It's not that if it's there, it actually means that it was during the crime that someone's left the fingerprint.
At the moment, we cannot date a fingerprint. And that is also a challenge for certain methods that are being used. So the older the print, sometimes certain methods do not work that well. The fresher the print, the easier normally it is to reveal a fingerprint. But it depends on the crime scene as well. I mean, if we're talking about a break-in and we know when it happened or between what time it happened, and you find the fingerprint of the perpetrator, except if he had any reasons to be there or can explain it in a different way, you do have an idea of when the fingerprint was left.
But the perpetrator has to be somewhere around. So this is the second challenge, meaning either you have him or her in a database or you have suspects. Right? It's not that every single person on earth has left the fingerprints and it's in the database. Although I know that the FBI's database is the biggest one in the world, but fortunately or unfortunately, they don't have all the fingerprints.
We do not have all the fingerprints. And that is the same in Luxembourg. We have a database with suspects. And a lot of countries, they are also having database with people who work, for example, for the police or who attend the crime scenes, the paramedics. And that is more to eliminate them. And that isn't any form of...
So you are in the database.
I am in the database, yes. And same for DNA. Because I can contaminate, I mean, it hasn't happened, but you never know if something slips out of your hand in the lab and you need to always make sure that you can control or control as much as possible what is happening. But to have an elimination database is actually a very good thing to take people out of the system because we have a lot of not identified fingerprints in the database, which probably belong to firefighters out there. And we should never forget that we actually have the Prüm Convention. So these fingerprints are being sent to most of Europe. Most of the countries are taking part in this convention. So these fingerprints are being sent and they are compared to their database. And you might be then a suspect in a break-in or even a murder because you attended a scene. But as a firefighter, you had an actual reason to be there. A lot of people are quite wary about these elimination databases because they always think that the police can control their DNA or their fingerprints, but that's actually not the case.
That's good you mentioned that. I think it's an important point. And then another important point, I think that there are way more challenges than the two I mentioned. But the challenge for Luxembourg, loads of challenges, but one I see is the fact that, well, we're still a small country and you can't have 20,000 experts in the crime lab, right? So what do you do then? You consult experts from abroad?
So we do consult quite a lot with colleagues from different countries. I mean, we are attending conferences, we have regular meetings with the countries, the neighboring countries anyways, and we have a lot of conventions where we can help them, they can help us. So, I mean, that is something that has been going on for quite a long time because we are so small. And if we are talking alone only about robberies, I mean, it's so easy if they break in here within 5 minutes, they're in a different country. So, and that is quite a challenge. So if we do not have these conventions with different countries, we would have quite an issue. But we do that with a few different areas in forensic science. For example, at the moment, we are not doing any fiber analysis, and which is actually quite a useful tool. And we are planning on building that up here in Luxembourg. But at the moment, for fingerprints, we are 4 people in the laboratory, and we are trying to build the fiber part up from scratch, which is quite a big challenge. But we consult experts from outside also to help us build this up.
So if you want to go into forensic science, probably you want to study, you want to get into that, fiber is your choice. Or not. I mean, at least in Luxembourg.
There will definitely be openings for that in the future.
Although it does take quite a few years in order to be an expert. So I don't know whether there'll be still openings in like 5 years from now, but who knows?
Well, I think we're recruiting quite a bit of people and I think we always will be needing people. The area is expanding. I mean, there are still a lot of things that we don't do. It's not just fibers, it's also archaeology. We are not looking at the bones at the moment. We also need to ask experts from different countries for that. I mean, there are plenty of areas areas that you can look in. I mean, even in DNA, it's not the police themselves here in Luxembourg who actually do the analysis, but it's the LNS, the Laboratoire National de la Santé. But if you look at the US, for example, they do also a lot of genealogy. So that is actually the science of looking at not just your DNA and to have a match with your DNA, but they look at maybe your brother is in a database or your parents, and they can actually figure out from your parents or your brother then that you might be a suspect in one of their cases.
You mentioned DNA, so that's the other elephant in the room, I have to say, at least from my understanding. It seems that right now that we can make those analyses, everyone is like, okay, DNA is there, clear case solved. You're saying yes.
No, I need to laugh. Yes, a lot of people actually have that perception that once you have DNA, it's all good. I mean, the analysis have become really, really performant in recent years in DNA, and we've have a lot of cold cases that they reopen and they do actually find the suspect. But DNA is not a god. I mean, you always need to look at all the different evidence that you have, because you never know if a person has had a reason to be there, especially if we're talking in family murder. People have been there, their DNA will be in the same room. They don't deny to be there. But if you have their fingerprints on the murder weapon, or you find other traces, or even if you discover a body and then you find fibers there, you do have also a lot of value for your investigation. And it's not just about the DNA, because you will not always find DNA. And that is an issue we sometimes have with not identified victims that we find that are already quite decomposed or in a mummified state. You are not always capable of actually extracting their DNA for an identification in this case.
And is this when you try to reconstruct the fingerprints?
Exactly. So when we have non-identified victims, we try to find a way of identifying them by any means. If they're already mummified, it's really difficult to take their fingerprints. So we actually try to figure out a way to restore the fingerprints, to actually give them the fluids back inside. And that's a process that takes a month or two. It's quite lengthy. And once we actually get to the point that we restore the fingerprints and we can actually take the print, what we then do, this doesn't sound too nice, but we take off the external part of the skin of the fingerprint, and we actually put it on our own fingers, wearing gloves, of course. And then we actually take the fingerprints. So we have a proper, nice, smooth background to actually take the print from the skin.
That's a lot of work. And then, of course, again, you don't have a guarantee that after that you will actually be able to match that fingerprint.
Exactly. If the person is not in the database, we might not be able to identify them. And this is also why it's important to take all kind of evidence that you find for different analysis, and not just fingerprints and DNA. But we did have a few cases like that. It doesn't have to be a murder where you don't have a victim that is identified. It can be an accident, a tourist being here before anyone even reports them missing. It can sometimes take some time. And then you have homeless people who not necessarily have anyone who reports them missing. And then it's quite difficult to find out who they are.
There are sometimes cases of people are wondering whether in this grave was someone buried. Is there a kind of a moment when you say, okay, we can't even try to reconstruct the fingerprints?
Yes. If you really have a completely mummified body, they have been successfully, I think, in 1920 something. They actually tried this on Egyptian mummies, and they were able to restore the fingerprints. So I'm not saying it's impossible to do, but it is really, really hard. And also, you should always remember that the body is still decomposing even at that stage. So even trying to rehydrate it, it can still decompose and the skin might just like crumble and fall apart. So it is a process that takes a lot of time. Also, taking the skin off is a process, even for one finger or even just the tip, you can sometimes spend at least 45 minutes trying to get it off without damaging the skin. I mean, the epidermis on the outside of our outside layer of skin, it is a very, very tiny layer. So you have to be very careful, yeah.
I want to go into the future of forensic science, but before we do that, there is also a way of kind of dating the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the flies and larvae and the state they are in.
Exactly. So you can, on one hand, look at the temperature of the body. If it's a recently deceased person, you can kind of calculate from the temperature of the body for how long they've been dead for. But then you need to know the temperature outside or in the house where they've been found, was the heating on or not. So there are a lot of components that can change this. And it's exactly the same things with bugs. If you know it's been really hot or if the body has been inside of a house, that already changes a lot. So you will have different maggots on the body. But if you take the maggots, you can actually rear them to their final stage and calculate by the time that they need to grow to that stage for how long the body has been lying there.
And do you have a bug expert lab as well? Or you're,
we do
in
not.
This case, you're also asking experts abroad.
We are asking experts abroad. But this is also more an area for the pathologist who are actually performing the autopsies. Mm-hmm. They will call in experts.
Okay. Now, hopefully, the future is, let's say, less picturesque, if I can use that word, in the sense that I'm always thinking, you know, I don't know, AI analysis and different systems and different ways of figuring out stuff. So tell me if I'm wrong or not. What's the future?
Oh, I think we still have a lot of development to do in forensic science. And I think it's one of the sciences that isn't as developed as other areas, such as in biology or chemistry, because it's such a vast area and it is more used in policing. But here in Luxembourg, I think we still have a lot to look forward to. I mean, there are many areas we can still explore. We are using a lot of external experts, and I think we have the potential. We have people who are capable of doing this. You don't have to be a pure forensic scientist to go into forensic science. We have biologists working with us, chemists working with us, and all these different areas. And I think that's what makes it actually a really nice field. You don't just work with people who have done the same thing as you. We are very diverse, and that is actually really nice.
And what about the developments in fingerprints? Any new methods around the corner? Anything that you're using only recently?
Yes, we actually started using VMD, which is vacuum metal deposition. And we are working together with a laboratory from Germany and also Switzerland and Austria to have a better performance of the actual method. And we actually only started using it last year, so it's not accredited yet. But as soon as it will be, we will definitely use it on cases as well.
So how does it work? You take a metal, I understand, like gold, for example, mm-hmm. right? I don't know. In Luxembourg, probably it's gold.
Maybe I'm only wrong. In Luxembourg.
You put it on the fingerprint under a vacuum or not?
Yes.
What's the process?
So the point of having a vacuum is that the evaporation of the metal, so we actually heat it. So the gold has to evaporate. And the idea is that it's really going everywhere onto your surface. So you don't have a concentration of gold only on a certain part. And your fingerprint will be entirely covered in gold. And on the fingerprint ridges, the gold will agglomerate, so we will have bigger pieces actually of gold, whereas in between, in the furrows, you only have a little amount of gold. And you need to do a second metal evaporation, so it's not just gold. And we use at this point zinc for the evaporation of the second metal. And that will actually form a complex with the gold in the furrow. So we actually have a nice difference between the zinc, which is more of a silver color, and then the gold with the gold color, obviously. And you can properly see your fingerprints.
That must be beautiful as well to see. It's a pity that it's just like, okay, photo, next.
It's very, very beautiful. There are different methods that you can use, even silver. And we're doing a lot of research into what kind of metals that we can use on different surfaces, because sometimes you get surfaces that aren't quite 100% porous or non-porous, so you're more in between. Same as fabrics, it's not that easy to recover fingerprints from fabrics, and it is also something where this method is actually quite useful for.
Okay, so that's yet another idea, and I'm sure there are loads of ideas coming, you know, especially in fields that we can't even think of right now, because science is developing so fast. But also, I think here it's constant training and constant consultation with experts, because it's just so many different ways and so many different methods that you have to actually learn to use, especially if you're a small lab.
Exactly. And I think it's very important to attend a lot of conferences. And that is something that we are quite happy to do. And also that we even have the opportunity to do that. And We are going to conferences not only here in Europe, we're working quite closely with our German neighbors. We have conferences even overseas in the United States. And that is something that is very, very important, not just for your own field, but I think it's important to be updated not only in fingerprints, but in different areas so that you know how you can improve the way we work here to work better with other fields and to just see where the development is going and what will be the future, and that you know what will come to you and how you will have to adapt to that as well. It's not just a job where you will stay constant. Now you know how your methods work and that's it. If you do not like that, that is not the right field for you. It's a constant development. And if I compare it, I've started 7 years ago working here. The methods we used then, the methods we're using now, it already completely changed. The lab has completely changed. And I think that is great. And it's way forward in a positive way, of course.
I guess that gives us the answer to the pub quiz question, more or less, or not. But I think it's a good moment to kind of wrap up at least that bit and ask you to ask the question once again, and then if you can give us the answer.
So the question I asked was, how many analyses did we do back in 2019 in the laboratory for fingerprints? And how many we did in 2022? Within those 3 years, how big was the increase? We actually had 1,044 analyses that we did in the lab back in 2019. And in 2022, we were already at 3,141 analyses. And that was an increase of nearly 200%. So within 3 years, we increased quite a lot of all the analysis that we need to do. And this is only for fingerprints. I also have statistics for DNA and different fields that we are also doing here in Luxembourg. And it's the same in all the fields.
I have to. Why?
So one very obvious answer for this is, of course, the population has increased quite a bit over the recent years in Luxembourg, and we are still increasing and we're having more and more people here. And of course, people are more informed about crimes as well. So they hear more about it, they report more crimes, which is also a good thing, because if we look back at especially like something like domestic violence, it's something people didn't used to report that much as they do now. And it's also good that people are more informed, so they will report more crimes and not be ashamed that something has happened to them. Same for rape. Rape is still an issue that is, I mean, in all the countries, people are very afraid of reporting it. They feel guilty or they are not really sure what has happened. And I think people are more aware nowadays, so they will report also more crimes.
So it doesn't mean we should be afraid. That's what you're trying to say.
Absolutely not. If you look at the cases that we do have, it's not like we have murder every day here. And it also depends on where the murders are. I mean, if we have something like the Trou walking around here, people will get informed about that. It's not that nobody will know about it. If there will be a serial killer, people will know about it. But I mean, we have a lot of suicides as well in Luxembourg, and that is something that we do not need to inform the public about. That is something quite private, and the family also has enough issues dealing with the whole consequences of that. And that is something people, in my opinion, don't need to know.
What they need to know is that they definitely have a chance, a great chance to work in forensic science, because there's a lot of opportunities, a lot of openings. And as you said, very diverse, ever-changing, a lot to learn, a lot to perfect, and growing as such.
Exactly. It's a field that is changing constantly. And compared to other sciences, I think it has even more potential still now, still a lot of growth to do. And that is fantastic.
With this positive attitude, it's not very easy to be positive about forensic science, I have to say, because if we get into the cases and then, you know, the imagination starts working. But I wanted to finish on a positive note. So, and thank you very much, Valérie, for today. It was really interesting. And yes, keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was great. Thank you.
Now, this is it for today. Don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to check what we're doing on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, social media in general. And of course, if you have any suggestions for future guests, we're always open to listen to you. This was Silex, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.